What's up, baby? It's Bretzky, and I'm here to tell you that SpinQuest.com is giving out free sweeps coins. All you gotta do is purchase a $10 coin pack, and guess what? They're gonna give you the coins from a $30 coin pack. That lets you play all your favorite games like Blackjack, Wanted, Dead or Wild, and we're talking real cash prizes, baby. SpinQuest.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. I welcome Ned Ryan, the author of a new book about American history, The Adversaries, a story of Boston and Bunker Hill. This is Boston, late 1774, early 1775. The events between the alienation of the Bostonians and the people of Massachusetts by their king and the Battle of Bunker Hill, also known as the Battle of Breed's Hill. Ned, congratulations and good evening. And I take you to a scene in the spring of 1775 in the palace in London. King George has beckoned a man named Howe, Lord Howe, a general in his army, a long-serving general, then 45 years old, who is a family of servants of the king. These are soldiers and sailors, and he is a veteran of many North American wars. He beckons Lord Howe, and present also are General Clinton and General Burgoyne. What is the subject of this discussion, and what does Howe learn from the king? Good evening to you, Ned.
Good evening to you, John, and I really appreciate this opportunity. But no, you hit on a very interesting scene that spring of 1775. And the king and his ministers, Lord North, who's the prime minister, Lord Dartmouth, who was secretary of the colonies, have realized the situation in Boston and the colony of Massachusetts, but really all of the American colonies, is spiraling out of control. And they have come upon the solution is to send three of their better generals, William Howe, Henry Clinton, Johnny Burgoyne, gentleman Johnny Burgoyne, to Boston to help General Thomas Gage try and solve what is quickly devolved into what they consider sedition and rebellion. And it was really an interesting scene, John, in which William Howe is called to the palace. He's there with the king and Burgoyne, Clinton, and obviously Dartmouth and North. And the king tells him that he is going to send him to Boston. And people need to understand, I mentioned this in the book, William Howe and the Howe brothers. There was George Howe, there was Richard Howe, there was William Howe. These three brothers were known and beloved by the colonists, especially Massachusetts, because George Howe, who died tragically at a young age, he was in his early 30s, one of the most talented generals in the army at the time, dies in a skirmish around Ticonderoga during the French and Indian War in the arms of his main scout, a man by the name of Israel Putnam. And in response to that death, the colony of Massachusetts sends £250 to have a memorial built to George Howe in Westminster Abbey. So the Howe brothers are very close to the Americans. William Howe has run in a snap election in the fall of 1774 on the pledge not to seek active duty, to in fact resist active duty in the colonies. He's voted against the Intolerable Acts, and now he's been called to the palace in which King George III looks at him and says, I am sending you to Boston. You will help Gage solve this problem and bring the Americans into submission. And William Howe looks at him and really confesses to being conflicted and said, are you asking me or are you ordering me? And George III says, I'm ordering you, but I would hope that if I asked you, you would have listened to your king. And William Howe finds himself on a boat with the two other generals headed to America. And he arrives in the end of May 1775, and just a few weeks later, despite his being conflicted, he finds himself in command of the British forces going up what is Breed's Hill and what we now know as the Battle of Bunker Hill. He is the commander of the British forces that day, and it's a very interesting story that highlights the conflict that a lot of English felt about coming to violence with the American colonies.
The Intolerable Acts, that was the driver for the alienation,
right.
The final alienation. The Intolerable Acts were a series of parliamentary actions meant to punish Massachusetts, punish Boston in particular, because of its conduct for many years, but certainly the Tea Party destroying those assets of the East India Company. Now, a detail about the Intolerable Acts. They aroused a lot of unhappiness in Boston, but you concentrate on one young man, Dr. Joseph Warren. What do we need to know about Joseph Warren?
Joseph Warren, Dr. Joseph Warren, young Harvard-educated doctor, protege of Samuel Adams, but quickly becomes his equal, and I would argue that really one of the leaders not only in Boston and Massachusetts, but even across the colonies in those last 9 or 10 months before Bunker Hill. He becomes president of the Provincial Congress. He becomes a major general in the new army. But if you even look back in the years before that, it was really his idea for the committees of correspondence. He authored a lot of those missives from the committees of correspondence that then, of course, go throughout the colonies, informing people what was taking place in Massachusetts. But, John, you're right. The Intolerable Acts were something that were extremely draconian. The thing I discovered in this is that they were all based off suggestions by Thomas Gage, sent back to England, obviously formalized, codified into law by Parliament, sent back, shutting down Boston Harbor, the Boston port, annihilating self-rule, self-governance, suspending the Charter of Massachusetts. There were a lot of things where all of a sudden, that year of 1774, these colonists who were English, I mean, this is the one thing, John, 85% of Massachusetts at the time is direct English lineage, not Scottish, not Irish. You have Englishmen looking at each other from either side of the Atlantic, really starting to understand we can't even agree on some fundamentals. Who makes the laws? Who governs? How are those laws supposed to be made? And they realize that as it comes into 1775, well, we can't find compromise. What's the next step? And a lot of them realize, you see this in correspondence from British officers, we're headed towards civil war.
Warren is convinced, but at the same time, he has conversations with others in his ilk about the difference between being free, having liberty, and also being an obedient subject of the king. This is not straightforward. This is not like the king is a tyrant. We must revolt. He has one particular conversation, I believe, with Sam Cooper, Silver Tongue Cooper.
The
rector of Brattle Street Church. In that conversation, I heard doubt from Warren. Do you think Warren doubted his actions because he wanted to be loyal to the king and yet he could not tolerate the Intolerable Acts?
I think there at some point there is this conflict, because they were really blaming a lot of the Intolerable Acts on Parliament and the king's ministers, and didn't want to blame King George III. In fact, they called the British troops the Ministerial Army. They really did. They considered themselves good and loyal subjects to King George III, and viewed initially the real villains as being Parliament and the king's ministers. And so I include that conversation because I think that's one of the things they had to struggle with. We want to be able to have a conversation about our rights, what we believe we're entitled to, not only as human beings, but Englishmen. And we're having these rights removed. And, you know, we're being called seditious and rebellious for even questioning some of these things, when in fact all we want is to be free, to have the right to govern ourselves, as we've done very well for the previous 150 years. So I wanted to include that conversation because I do think it's something they struggled with and had to get it straight in their own heads. If we truly believe this and they will not compromise, what is then the next step? And are we prepared to actually go to that next step?
Gage is the commander, the governor general of the colonies, because they've been deprived of their own self-rule with the Intolerable Acts. Gage also is of mixed opinion. He's married to an American colonist.
That's right.
He hesitates to use strong methods, and yet he's told again and again that they're raising an army. Was that accurate, Ned? Were they actually raising a 15 or 13,000 man army, or was that a projection?
No, by the fall, the British royal government has come to total collapse in the fall of 1774. And as the provincial Congress, based off representatives from the various towns in Massachusetts, has come together, Warren is one of the driving forces in which he says, and he's starting to come to this realization, if we're going to be free, we're probably going to have to fight for it. I don't want to, but we probably will. We have to prepare. And so they did. And one of the things, John, that I found interesting, I knew that they had been drilling, obviously, the Minutemen and drilling the militia on a weekly, if not biweekly, basis. The active smuggling of arms into the colonies from the Netherlands, from Germany, as they're preparing, as they're smuggling in gunpowder and muskets and cannons to fight.
Oh, I understand. Gunpowder, and that will inform the decisions made on Breed Hill, on Bunker Hill. But that number 15,000, that number 13,000, these were farmers. You emphasize that. They have no skills whatsoever to maneuver with a force that large. So was it real, or was it Gage's fears that made that number important to him?
No, it was, well, it was real because they had the ability to even call up 30,000. They projected perhaps 30,000 Massachusetts colonists could be under arms and come to Boston.
Okay.
And I think the real fear was that they might actually figure out how to organize and formalize into an army, which was a real struggle in those 8 weeks between Lexington and Concord and Bunker Hill. But that was the fear, and that's what the Americans were trying to do and eventually got to.
What was Lexington about? What was Concord about? It was about gunpowder and arms.
That's right.
But chiefly gunpowder. What was Salem about? It was about gunpowder. Gage's idea was that if we deprive them of gunpowder, therefore it's just talk. We'll turn to something that wasn't talk. That's the Battle of Bunker Breeds Hill in June of 1775. The book is The Adversaries, Boston and Bunker Hill. Ned Ryan is the author. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
Stay tuned for more of CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor. Ned Ryan, the author of the new book, A Story of Boston and Bunker Hill, entitled The Adversaries. These are scenes that make a great deal of sense with the history we have of the events from late 74 into the clash of arms on Bunker Breeds Hill. These are two separate high rises over Charlestown and over Boston Harbor in June of 1775. But we'll get to the day itself. Ned, Gage is in charge, but Clinton, Burgoyne, and Howe are present. They have sufficient troops, very good troops, grenadiers, marines, light infantry.
Some of the best.
Right, and some of these troops have already clashed with the farmers in the march on Lexington and Concord, but they regard them as farmers, not as someone, as a group that can stand up to fix bayonets and lower and charge, which is what the British know how to do. Now, Gage, Clinton, Burgoyne, and Howe all see the same scene. Why do they decide to cross in boats and attack the hill? What is their concern that particular day?
Well, they're concerned that day on June 17th when they wake up and realize the Americans have built this earthen redoubt right above the town of Charleston across, you know, from Boston across the Charles River. They realize that it is now so close to Boston that if the American colonists are able to place cannons in this earthen redoubt, it puts the warships under fire, but also puts a lot of Boston within reach of any cannon. And so they realize if we do not run the Americans off of what is technically Breeds Hill that afternoon of June 17th, our days in Boston are numbered. We will find ourselves very soon on ships sailing for Nova Scotia, because it will be untenable. Our position in Boston will be untenable. And so they have this council of war that morning of June 17th, in which they come to the plan in which they will transport 2,000 troops across the Charles River to the Charlestown Peninsula, and those 2,000 troops will run the Americans off the hill, fix bayonets, march up the hill. And, you know, there was this arrogance with Howe and even others that they really thought the provincials, these farmers, at the sign of a bayonet charge, will turn tail and run. But Lord Percy, who's one of the other senior British officers who actually helped rescue the British forces in Lexington and Concord that day, says they have men among them who know what they are doing. Don't be so sure that they're going to turn and run at a bayonet charge. And, of course, it plays out in a very brutal about hour and a half battle on those slopes of Breeds Hill, in which the British had a rude awakening that these were men the Americans were prepared to fight and could fight very well.
The layout of the rises. Breeds Hill was the original understanding of what we're going to reinforce, somewhat back from Charlestown. Breeds Hill is right above Charlestown, the high point.
Correct.
Bunker Hill is back about 200 or 300 yards?
I'd say about a quarter mile, a little over a quarter mile behind it. But you're right, Charlestown, it's right above the city. And the thing, John, I would actually look at it, I think better technical term for the whole day was the Battle of Charlestown Heights.
Okay.
Because people look at the earthen redoubt as the only fight, but there was the rail fence. There was a brutal fight on the Mystic River Beach, which is on the other side of the peninsula. But it was really three major conflicts on that day at three different points in which any one of them could have turned one way or the other and actually shortened the battle, or, you know, if we'd had enough gunpowder, the Americans would have won. But it should be technically the Battle of Charleston Heights.
All right. I go along with a theme that you introduced several times in your telling of the battle, which is extremely dramatic. And there are paintings that you can refer to. And I urge everybody to visit what Ned has profiled here, because once you're on the terrain, you understand the challenge to the British troops in Boston and to the British Navy in Boston Harbor. It's this theme. We've gone too far. We can't go back. This will be too much. We can't return from this. They have these doubts as they open fire on each other that there's no going back. And I felt the same thing, Ned. We've gone too far. This can only be settled with violence, with blood, with death. And yet, it sickened them. It sickened Howe. It sickened Putnam. It sickened Warren, if I read you correctly.
Yes. No, I mean, this is one of the things, and I have. There was a prisoner exchange about 11 days before the actual battle where Dr. Joseph Warren, Israel Putnam, and some of the British officers make a prisoner exchange of British regulars and officers and American troops that were captured at Lexington and Concord. And they make this exchange. And then actual history, they go and sit and have drinks and refreshments together and exchange all the stories, because these people fought together. These were brothers in arms during the French and Indian War. And John Small and Israel Putnam were good friends, close friends. So it's one of those things where you have men who knew each other, who were friends, who had actually, you know, fought in all parts of the world, all of a sudden they find themselves 11 days later actually shooting at each other, killing each other. And it's this whole horrifying realization that they're friends and they were allies and now they are adversaries. And the only way they will get back to normal is obviously when one side decides that they're going to stop fighting and it would go on for another 6 years.
Why didn't they cut the neck, Charles' neck? Why didn't they cut it and just lay siege to the farmers?
Well, this was Henry Clinton's idea, that they would have an amphibious assault on either side of the Charlestown neck, which is a relatively narrow strip of land. Land troops on either side, cut off the troops on Charleston Peninsula from the troops in Cambridge. And Howe and Gage and some of the other officers nixed the idea because they were afraid it would put a relatively small British force between what they thought would be several thousand that were already on the Charlestown Peninsula and several thousand more in Cambridge. And so they said, we're not going to do that. We will have a frontal assault, which in hindsight they realized it was a 50% casualty day for the British. Over 200 died outright, 800 wounded, but of those 800 that were wounded, another several hundred died over the next few weeks and months from their injuries received on June 17th.
In the first assault, Howe leads the right flank of the British line. A very good idea to attack the left flank of the farmers and get behind them. Who held the left flank? Who was responsible for turning Howe and the Grenadiers back?
John Stark of New Hampshire. He realizes the Mystic River beach is a weak point. He scrambles down to the beach. He pulls in 60 men, lines them up in three lines of 20, and all of a sudden when the Royal Welsh Fusiliers and the fourth, the King's Own, come around the corner, they realized we're not going to be able to roll up the American left flank. But John Stark's a pretty incredible figure. If you want to know where New Hampshire got the motto from, it's from a letter he wrote to his fellow veterans in 1809, in which he had a postscript in which he said, I leave you with this. Live free or die, there are worse things than death. And that's where New Hampshire's motto comes from John Stark, who protected the American left wing on the Mystic River beach. And really, quite frankly, it was one of the hot points in the battle that day, but it was because he had the foresight to understand we have to protect this beach.
I'm keen on Howe. It's Howe's point of view that's a fascination here. He saw that the first assault failed. He then saw the second assault failed. Why didn't he withdraw? What was his thinking for the third assault?
Well, first of all, he had ignored all of the advice and manuals from previous, in which if you were to attack a fortified entrenched position, you were to attack in columns. And in his arrogance, he attacked in four rows of about 200, right? So it's one of those things. He failed in his initial strategy. But they understood that if we don't drive the Americans off of this hill, the next couple of days we'll probably be on our ships sailing for Nova Scotia. It was conquer or die. And he realized, if we do not take this redoubt, again, our foothold in the American colonies will be in real question. It became one of those desperate things where he put the men into three columns. they attacked the redoubt, they focused on that, and were eventually able to get over the top because, quite frankly, the American colonists ran out of gunpowder.
Joseph Warren, he fought to the end, and
he did.
One reading is that he was executed. Is that, what is your opinion of his death?
You know, the one I went with is he's fighting rear guard action. He's covering the American retreat. He's in the middle of fighting off some of these grenadiers. And one of the British officers, and according to historical records, a British officer identified, saw Warren. They feared him. They loathed him. They hated him. And grabbed a musket from another soldier and at short range shot Warren in the head as he's fighting off grenadiers. But the British officers hated him. And one of the stories I try to really develop is between Dr. Joseph Warren and a young British officer, an Irishman by the name of Francis Lord Rawdon, to show that conflict, a microcosm of the cosm of the conflict between the Americans and the British. But it's felt that he was seen by a British officer and shot at point blank as he's fighting.
Ned, where's Warren's grave? How can people find it? We have 30 seconds.
Warren's grave is Forest Hill Cemetery, about 5 miles south of Boston. And John, I think one of the real tragedies is that his body was moved by a descendant of his from the old granary burial grounds on the Freedom Trail to this current place, because I think Joseph Warren would be better known if he was still in the old granary burial grounds.
June 17, 1775, the Battle of Charleston Heights. The Adversaries is the book, Boston and Bunker Hill. Ned Ryan is the author. This is CBS Eye on the World. I'm John Batchelor.
You're listening to CBS Eye on the World with John Batchelor.
I'm here with SpinQuest, where you can play and win from the comfort of your own home with hundreds of slot games and all of the table games you love with real cash prizes. Right now, $30 coin packs are on sale for $10 for new users. It's all at SpinQuest.com. That's SPINQUEST.com.
SpinQuest is a free-to-play social casino. Void where prohibited. Visit SpinQuest.com for more details.
Lots of places can expose you to identity theft. That's why LifeLock monitors hundreds of millions of data points a second for threats to your identity, which is way more than anyone can do on their own. If we find anything suspicious, like new loans or changes to your financial accounts, we alert you right away, all through text, phone, email, or the LifeLock app. Save up to 40% your first year. Visit LifeLock.com/iHeart. Terms apply.
Here's the truth. You could literally be adored by everyone and then come home and still get completely ignored by your own cat. It's classic cat behavior. But new Shiba Premium Puree is a lickable treat that changes all that. They're protein rich, made with bone broth, and have the smooth, creamy texture cats go crazy for, especially when it's hand fed. Yeah, it's more than a treat. It's a fast pass to favorite human status. So feed your cat Shiba and go from totally ignored to truly adored in just 12 days, guaranteed, or your money back. Learn more at Shiba.com.